It is Saturday, April 5th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 88.9 and KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak.
Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Mira Software Services, 1,500 software professionals specializing in machine-to-machine and the Internet of Things platform. Details at mera.biz or 650-479-5350.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or of the geeks' affiliated organizations. In the air with me today is Ben Jaffe, and Ben is a web instructor, a web development instructor, musician, and world traveler. Hey, Ben.
Hi. How's it going?
So, web developer instructor? You're not a developer anymore, or you're just a developer instructor?
I'm a web developer and web development instructor.
You need a comma in this document, sir.
I do front-end web development. I teach people how to do it.
And you also play music and all that as well.
Yeah, speaking of which, where'd the music go?
I decided to pull the music. I was listening to the back...
The Through With Being Cool song?
Yeah, I'm done with that song.
You're through with
it's
been 10 years or 12 years or more, I don't know. And I was listening to Geek Speak, and I realized, if you're a regular listener to Geek Speak, you hear that every single week. And though I use it as a moment to prep for the next sentence I'm going to say, and as a breather and such, it's not necessary for the podcast. So you miss it, great. Tell us about it. We're going to get a different theme music in there so that it mixes it up a little bit more. We also have Lindsay Lonnie, systems analyst and web developer.
Good morning. Happy Saturday.
Well, thank you so much. I'm also a web developer, so we've got a lot of web development in the house, which is amazing because the Geek Speak website's down. So there you go.
Is it really?
There's that. Yeah, it's dead right now.
Oh, no.
It's not doing well. Something to do with the VPS I've got running it is having trouble with a network attached storage. So I can get on when the storage is up, and then I can access things. But
God, I hate web development.
I feel like getting a call out there. Can I get an admin, please?
Yeah, we don't know enough about this stuff.
I'll get it up eventually. Unfortunately, the podcast won't get updated until it's up so that NPR can scrape it. So it's a lot to do, and I'll probably do that.
So, if you're hearing this podcast, then you'll know that the podcast is not going to be up for a while.
Who knows? Anyway, so let's talk about skydiving since I want to get on with the show. Ben, skydiving, sir.
Have you been skydiving?
I've never done skydiving.
Lindsay? I did it once.
You did, Lindsay? What was it like?
It was super fun, actually.
Yeah. Did you do the tandem thing?
Yeah. I think when you're new, they don't let you go on your own.
Right.
You have to
have a certain experience.
Yeah. Because people often do freak out.
Yeah.
But I actually really enjoyed it. I thought it was super fun.
I've done bungee jumping. So jumping out of a tall thing.
Probably similar.
I have trouble jumping into a 70-degree swimming pool, not from a diving board. So I don't know if I'll ever be able to do skydiving. But thinking about skydiving, one of the things that you don't expect to see while you're skydiving is a rock. It turns out this guy, Anders Hellstrup, this guy in Norway, he was skydiving and he took all this footage and stuff. And, as people often do, have GoPros on their helmets and stuff. And he has one shooting one direction, another camera shooting another direction. And this is 2 years ago. He goes on this skydive. And then he's reviewing the footage. And for this brief instant, he sees a rock whiz by his head. And he's like, huh?
Was it an asteroid?
A rock?
Wait.
Yes. Yes. Isn't that ridiculous?
So it must have been really hot.
So he sent this footage to experts. And they figured out. I know, right? Like, what are the chances?
Yeah.
They figured out he had actually captured a meteor falling during what they call its dark flight. So when a meteor, when an asteroid hits Earth, it goes through all the atmosphere and it heats up because of all the, well, it's partially air friction. It's partially the compression of the air in front of the asteroid. Right. And so the asteroid gets really, really hot. And sometimes it explodes. Generally they glow.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you see asteroids, or when you go and see meteor showers, you see these glowing things, these little shooting stars. Well, it turns out sometimes these asteroids will slow down enough that they're just falling at their terminal velocity, right? And
so was he.
And they cool down, yeah. So he's flying at the terminal velocity of a human being, which is probably around 120 miles an hour, and not quite that fast. And he sees this rock fly past him. So this is the only time in known human history, probably in human history, where anyone has ever captured on video an asteroid falling to Earth during its dark flight phase.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. So that means that this one would have actually had an impact.
Probably, because it's just a falling rock.
But then again, it's only going a couple hundred miles an hour, something like that, in terms of velocity of rock, right? Since it's not really hot, it's not slowing down, therefore it's falling at its terminal velocity of a rock.
Uh-huh. So, 300 kilometers per hour,
okay,
which is about, quick math, 200 or
yeah,
so.
Yeah, something like that.
Around 200.
So, do we think this is true? Because it seems really unlikely. I mean, there's not that many asteroids hitting Earth. Like, for... I've stood around a lot, and I've never heard a rock hit the Earth, you know?
Well, okay.
So, imagine.
So it's clearly very, very unlikely,
yeah,
right? But at the same time, the Earth is really, really big.
Yeah,
and,
but
you
isn't
know,
it?
There are 7 billion people on this planet, but really, when you think about it and you do all the math and everything, you get somewhere, I did the math once, and it was somewhere between 1 and 5 acres per person. I might be totally wrong with the math, I might be remembering wrong, but basically, for every human, there is a massive amount of land, and most of the people on Earth are compressed into these things, these massive blobs called cities.
Granted.
So basically, there are rocks hitting the Earth all the time.
Yeah.
And we very rarely encounter them. Like, they don't hit us. They don't hit our cars very often.
I get that.
I bet there's some statistics person out there that can calculate, you know.
Yeah, I mean, how many people are actually in free fall at any one time on the Earth, you know?
Yeah.
Let's say less than 1,000, right? I mean, that seems like a lot of people falling. But maybe that's about right. Maybe there's always 1,000 people falling. That's kind of amazing.
I don't know.
Now, it seems so much more likely that some guy in the plane above him threw a rock out. You know, it's like, that's what it is.
Well, I don't think that seems likely at all, because the plane is going off in one direction.
Oh, they circle.
And he's going straight down.
You don't know.
Wow, looking at this picture.
Oh, there's like multiple.
It is super close. I didn't realize how close it really was to him.
He actually got multiple frames. Yeah, that's really, really close.
He got multiple frames.
Can you imagine being that close?
He's got to figure out, he's got to find that rock. That's what he has to do.
Uh-huh.
He won the lucky lottery that day.
No kidding.
Well, except that... What if it had hit him, you know?
Well, like, it's only... but it's a rock going the speed of a baseball. I mean, it would have hurt. You could have killed him. But his differential speed wasn't that great.
He's wearing a parachute.
Yeah.
And, you know, it could be like a...
be horrible if it ripped through his parachute.
Yeah. I mean...
Oh, that's unfortunate for me. Let me open my second. Let's move on, shall we? Let's, since we're talking about... it's not an asteroid if it's in our area, right?
Man,
It's a meteorite or meteor... Oh, let's not even go into that. We've done that before.
If you want... There's a meteorite, asteroid.
It's on the ground, it's a meteorite. It's not an asteroid.
Oh, wow.
It was a meteor because it was in flight.
I think.
Right.
Yes.
So is that the first photograph of a meteor in atmosphere? No, maybe not. Who knows? Anyway, let's move on. Since we're talking about space,
in the article.
NASA. What's NASA up to, Lindsay?
NASA.
Mm. Meteorite.
There's video on the GeekSpeak website once we get the GeekSpeak website up.
All right.
Stress. I'm going to go code.
I'm sorry.
Lindsay. NASA.
All right. I'll tell you a little something about NASA. They're releasing a master list of over 1,000 software projects that they've created over the years. They basically, within a few weeks of publishing this list, they're also going to offer a searchable database. And by next year, they're hoping to host the actual software code on their own online repository, kind of like a GitHub for astronauts.
Okay.
Oh, that's cool.
What software is it?
Just their projects that they've created.
Like all of it?
Well, most of it, yeah.
Wow,
because
that's pretty amazing.
Considered kind of like a government organization. So it's part of a White House-directed push to open up the federal government. So these software projects are already available through a technology transfer program that's been running for over 50 years. But there's over 10 offices for NASA that make their different projects. And there's almost no way to find what you're looking for or find what they have that's available unless you already know somebody who can tell you, oh, yeah, we wrote something for that. And you can sign the paperwork and get a hold of it. Because a lot of it's not open sourced.
Yeah.
But all the software that NASA writes is copyright free. So if it's not open source, you would normally need to get
clearance. Why is it copyright free? Because it's a government organization, therefore it's owned by the public.
Right.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, and so normally if it's not open source, you need to get cleared by NASA for a release. But sometimes that's as easy as proving that you're a U.S. citizen and signing a usage agreement. The problem is that with more than 1,000 projects that have been created, it's just hard to find what you're looking for. So this is all part of just opening everything up. They're hoping that it'll, you know... make it easier to help hackers and entrepreneurs like push existing ideas that they've created and help them dream up new ideas.
Yeah, I mean, open sourcing projects like that makes so much sense.
Some of the stuff where companies have actually signed the paperwork to get access to stuff has given us like Dustbusters, the Giro bicycle helmets. They took the Hubble Space Telescope star mapping algorithm and they're identifying endangered white shark or whale sharks, you know, those big huge ones that look like whales, but
yeah,
they're fish.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's so awesome.
They're mapping those and now they adapted to track polar bears in the Arctic and sunfish in the Galapagos. So like stuff like that is what they want people doing with the software once they can find what they're looking for.
Huh.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I love that so much. You know, one of the things I like just so I love when we go to space or we go to Earth orbit and we do cool things up there. But what I love even more is when we take the technology we developed for that and then find a way to use it here on Earth again.
Because then we get to play with it.
That's just cool.
So can you imagine like being able to just log into their website and download the Hubble software? You know, like how cool is that?
That's awesome.
And then you have to figure out how to run it.
Well, you'd have to have hardware.
Yeah.
I guess somebody could then create a virtual machine for the Hubble Spacecope. That'd be pretty awesome.
And what, run that in parallels or something?
Basically.
What is your machine? Windows XP, Windows 7, Hubble Space Telescope.
I got to say, I'm very happy right now because when I said, I'm going to start coding right now, I actually kind of meant it and ran the commands necessary to download the data from the GeekSpeak server, and I did.
Yay.
So I got a database dump and I got the images. I don't know if the machine will be up, but at least I haven't lost any data. So, and yes, I have not done well at doing backups on that machine.
Oh, no.
It's a virtual. It's in the cloud. But every time I have trouble accessing, I'm like, I don't have a database for like months. Oh, well.
This is a PSA.
Yes. Back up your machines, even your virtual ones.
Don't be like us.
It's also a live programming show.
That's right. Live programming. I did it. It's like two commands were in my cache. I went ahead and grabbed all the images as well from episodes. But anyway,
a couple days ago, my computer died, and so I had to buy a new computer. So
is that why you
computer.
Have that shiny, fancy thing
oh,
in front of you?
It's so beautiful.
This is not a commercial for Apple, but he loves his Apple.
Oh, whoever said it was an Apple. Well, yeah. Anyway, beautiful computer. But along with it, I decided, you know what? If I'm already spending this much money, I may as well spend money on a big hard drive. And then I'll have a really good backup solution because now I have a bigger hard drive in my machine. I'll have a bigger hard drive to back it up to. I actually got a 2 terabyte, 2.5 inch drive, the small portable ones. They're USB powered. And I got a 4 gigabyte external drive.
Wait, so internal you got a spinning disk?
Oh, and I'm sorry. Internal, I have a 512 gigabyte SSD.
Yes, oh my gosh. Beautiful. I have to say, anybody that wants a fast computer, get an SSD for your machine. That's a solid state drive. They're fantastic. I thought, for example, for a minute, because you're video editing craze, you'd got a spinning disk to have more space inside your machine.
No.
Crazy, man. All right.
But yeah, so I have a better backup. I have a good backup solution. Now I just have to
What are you using for your backup?
For backing up.
Yeah.
I use a program called Super Duper.
Oh, yeah. I love Super Duper.
There's also Carbon Copy Cloner. They're both for the Mac. One of them may be for Windows. I'm not sure. I haven't looked recently.
I'm not sure.
So
Lindsay, is it for the Windows? No, it doesn't matter.
After GeekSpeak, I'll be transferring
crash plan
gigabytes of data.
All right. You want a copy of the GeekSpeak website?
Sure, why not? I've got the space now.
By the way, that's an open source project, and it's actually hosted on GitHub. And just to totally mess with you guys, let's move forward to the source control stuff. I'm pushing us through the show a little bit. What is Microsoft doing? You did the NASA story, Lindsay. So maybe, Ben, do you want to do the story about Subversion? Gosh, we have so much to talk about. And you know what we're going to do first? You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Lindsay Lonnie and Ben Jaffe. We're talking about tech news of the week. And a minute ago, I mentioned that it's not exactly time to visit geekspeak.org because it's down, and that actually the entire source project for geekspeak.org is up at GitHub under my account. I'm Lyle on GitHub. And you can look at all the source control if you're Ruby on Rails editor, or coder. Take a look. And of course, it's got some JavaScript and HTML and such. But it's not exactly time for that. Instead, it's time for what, Lindsay?
For MS-DOS and Word for Windows.
Oh, I was leading into the time geek bit thing.
Oh.
Yeah, we'll do that in a second.
The time. Atomic clock.
Now is not the time to talk about the time. We don't have the time.
So the U.S. just got a new super accurate atomic clock. And I will post a picture up there once we have access to the site. But the old atomic clock, have you heard of NIST, N-I-S-T?
No.
The National Institute of Standards and Technology.
Ah, they're the ones that define everything.
Yes. The new atomic clock was unveiled Thursday in Boulder, Colorado by NIST. It's a branch of the U.S. Department of Commerce. Mm-hmm. And the NIST F2 is what it's called. It was in development for about a decade, and it's wow. three times more accurate than the F1, which has been in use since 1999. Yeah, so three times more accurate means, I think, that it would only lose a second once every 300 million years.
That's an accurate clock.
Yeah.
Now, was there like a shiny unveiling? I imagine it in like a bell jar.
Right. That's what I imagined too. But when I went and looked at the picture, it doesn't look anything like I would have imagined. It's just this huge machine, and there's like Ethernet cable, zip tied. It's awesome.
Yeah. All right. So Geek Bits, of course, are something that we like to talk about that you have to see to believe. And this week, I guess, just do a geek search or something for it. Do a Google search for it. But let's talk about source control. What did Microsoft do? You just talked about NASA releasing source control. And first, let's do Ben's story about...
All right. Yeah, I want to talk about then Subversion and Git. They're both source control. Source control... What would you,
can I take a stab at it?
Do it.
When you write complicated applications, you need to keep track of the actual files that it's written in. And normally, programming languages are very commonly programming languages are written in one language, and then you compile it into another language. And prior to the compilation step, the language itself is what human programmers write in, what all three of us write in. We need to keep track of that. We need to keep track of anything that changes in it. And when you're doing collaboration, you need other people to look at it. And so all of that management of that code is called source control, because it's controlling the source. And Subversion, one I've used a long time ago, is one that has kind of a centralized repository where everybody checks in and checks out to that repository. And it seems like a really smart model for keeping track of source control. When you work at a company, the company hosts a Subversion box, and then you submit and receive stuff from Subversion. That project is an Apache project, which means it's an open source completely. You can use it any way you want, and it's been used for years. That's Subversion.
And then Git is very similar, except instead of a centralized kind of a thing where everyone checks into the same place, it's decentralized. Everybody has their own version of the Git repository, and then everyone can kind of synchronize through, if they want to, a central source, or it can be set up a number of other different ways.
Yeah, and Git was designed and created by Linus Torvalds, who also created the Linux operating system. And Torvalds, commonly as the maintainer of the source control for Linux operating system, he gets a lot of people communicating with him with these things called diffs and patches. And the idea is that if Lindsay makes a change, she doesn't need to send an entire copy over. She sends a small change, which is a text file format that shows the exact modifications to files and line numbers, and then I could take that in that one thing through email and submit it in my branch and run it. So it's a way of just doing small changes. And that pattern of sharing small changes with each other is how Git's designed. Okay. So when you use it, and I use it regularly in my job, it feels much more like it's a tool for yourself and for collaboration rather than source control. The actual name of it means to control source code. It's more like managing the source control, mm-hmm. source code.
Yeah, and you can use this on your own. Like here's another example. I write song lyrics, and I keep track of all of my song lyrics in using Git, in a Git repository. Mm-hmm. So as I go through and I make changes, and I check in those changes to my Git repository will figure out, or will keep track of, which changes I made when and how and what the name of the commit was and what the date was and all that stuff. If you're doing this with a lot of different people, let's say that you were writing a song together or working on code together, and then someone writes a total doozy of a line and it's just awful, you can go back like a month and figure out, oh, who wrote that line? When did they write it? Why did they write it?
And some people might know the same type of concept with track changes in Word documents and Google Docs and things.
Google Docs,
any
kind
of a text editor now should be able to support this idea of track changes. So as you change, as you make saves, you can see the history of the file. When you're doing creative endeavors like programming or writing music or writing anything, as you make a change, delete something or save something, there's an instinct to go, well, that old copy might be something I want to know about later. And so I'll copy a new file. And that's a very standard way of practicing when you get concerned about not losing information. And so with source control, it's just kind of built in, except that only the diffs get saved, so it doesn't get really large. Yeah. And I got to say that Cory Doctorow, who's an author and political mover and shaker in the copyright environment that I really appreciate, he's a great author, he has a whole system on his machine where regularly all of his files get checked into Git, and information about the weather, his location, what music he's listening to, other notes about his life get stored as notes to that commit. So years from now, if someone looks over his history of a book, they can find out exactly what he was doing during the writing of the book. It's private right now, but it's a really cool project.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So Subversion and Git, those are the two different source control projects
that we're
talking about. Sure. Right? The people who are maintaining and working on the Apache Subversion control project, or the Subversion project, have started, instead of using Subversion to control Subversion source code,
they're writing the application that is Subversion, which is a source control software package. So you would think that they would use Subversion to track the code that's written for Subversion.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And?
And a couple days ago, they decided, actually, we're moving to Git. which is like, what?
That's
it's kind of wacky. It's like they're building a tool.
I'm trying to think of an analogy, but it's really hard to come up with an analogy.
Well,
I guess if you
can come up with a very basic analogy, which is like, it's like, let's say everyone at Microsoft, the management for Microsoft decided everybody now has to use a Mac.
Right.
And they have to use OS X. Right. But it's even more complicated than that, because it's not even just that. It's that, actually, that kind of works, because then all the people at Microsoft are writing the code for Windows on something that's not running Windows.
Okay, this is not what we're saying, by the way. It's just an analogy.
That's an analogy. Right.
I guess another way to think about it is like I'm working on a new design for a tool, I'm working on a DeWalt screwdriver, electric screwdriver, right? But my tools are all Makita. Right, and I'm working along designing and creating, and I'm using the opposite tool. Anyway,
that's another way of thinking about
it. So Git is, and the reason why Git's being used is it's just superior in every single way than Subversion.
Mm-hmm.
The views expressed on GeekSpeak are not necessarily. I'm a Git fanatic.
I'm also a huge Git fan. I do have to say, though, that in reading all of this stuff, I didn't find a very clear, like, we're switching to this because Git is better. I didn't see any of that. So I can't say clearly in this news story that they're moving to Git because
so the reason
Git
we're really talking about it, the reason we're really talking about it is because we love source control and the whole concept of it. All right, let's move on. What Microsoft? Speaking of Microsoft, Ben,
and source control. Yeah,
Microsoft source code for MS-DOS and Word for Windows is available to the public now for initial, like, early '80s versions of that software. The help of the Computer History Museum last week, Microsoft released MS-DOS 1.1 and 2.0 and Microsoft Word for Windows 1.1a. So you can go look at the source code for those. But the source code for MS-DOS is less than 300 kilobytes for that version of MS-DOS. 300 kilobytes.
That's for the entire MS-DOS?
Yeah. Yeah.
So
isn't that crazy?
Why are they doing it? Like, why? So MS-DOS, of course, is the first operating system that most of us ever had. It's a core to the Microsoft success.
Mm-hmm.
And it being open source is kind of amazing, but why are they doing it? Like, what's the business plan for them to do that?
It's not a business plan necessarily. It's just that the Computer History Museum asked them about it, and they're curating it to help future generations of technologists better understand the roots of personal computing. So it's just that, help you understand the roots. Back in the early 80s, Microsoft had less than 100 employees, and 35 of them were working full-time for a year on the IBM contract to create MS-DOS. They needed an operating system, and they were contracted to do that. And Microsoft still wasn't, a major player, I guess, until, 1983, they released the first version of Word, and that's the one that they're making available. But it wasn't until 89 when they released Word for Windows that it became a blockbuster for them. So within 4 years of that, Word for Windows was generating over half the revenue of the worldwide word processing market.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a lot.
So that was the thing that really made them rich in a lot of ways.
Right, yeah, and since then they sold more than 200 million licenses of Windows 8, and they have over a billion people using Microsoft Office.
Billion. Yeah, wow, that's a lot of people using Microsoft Office. All right, Ben, let's just think of something completely random. Why do zebras have stripes?
No, I want to hear you try and build a segue.
<I know. laughs>
Speaking of Microsoft and...
In a minute, Lindsay's going to talk about a little PSA about Nest, and then we're going to get into some discussions about cars. But first, Ben, what's going on with zebras?
what's going on with zebras? Well, this has been going on with zebras ever since zebras were invented. I don't know.
Emerged.
That's just an awkward thing to say. Mm. But so yeah, zebras. So speaking of zebras and horses and all this stuff, why is it we're trying to figure out that zebras evolved stripes?
I always imagine that the flocking nature of zebras, like the idea of flocking, herding, the giant herding nature of zebras
flying together.
What is the plural noun for zebras? I don't know.
Zebras
is herd, but
it could be a herd, but it could be something clever. Plural nouns are always kind of sometimes clever, right? Like a mishmash or a zag.
You know, I'm going to Google that.
A zag of zebras.
Say what you're gonna say.
Anyways, I always assume that the reason why that happens is if you have a whole bunch of zebras running on the plains, their stripes are actually mostly vertical. When they're running and they go back and forth in a lot of changes in direction, it's actually confusing to the eye. So a predator in chase would get confused by all that zigging and zagging with the vertical stripes. So that's why I assumed it was.
Right, because you can't really see where one begins and the other one ends.
And there's a lot of lines moving all the time. Yeah, exactly. That's always what I had assumed. Is that the case, Ben?
Well, I'm giving up on my Google search. I couldn't figure out what the plural noun is. But here is one of the there are several hypotheses for this. That's one of them. And the one that I'm talking about today kind of got a little bit of a boost. And here's the proposed explanation. It all has to do with flies. So these tsetse flies, they bite. And the length of their, for lack of a better word for my brain, noshers, their mouth, right? They're trying to bite these animals. And horses have fur that's thick enough that the flies land on them and they can't really bite them very well.
Okay.
And they can't pierce the skin very well. Zebras have very thin fur.
Huh.
So the theory goes that as these paths, evolutionary paths, diverged, horses got thicker fur to deal with the flies, and the zebras got the stripes to deal with the flies. So that raises the question, why is it that flies don't like stripes? Well, here's the proposed explanation for that, which is that flies apparently prefer to land on dark surfaces because of the polarized light and the color and everything. It reminds the flies of the water or the mud where they tend to breed,
okay,
says the theory. Light surfaces are not as attractive, but dark light patterns are even worse because the flies get confused. You know, if you have mud doesn't come in stripes. You know,
so it is confusing a predator, but it's a parasitic predator. So
the flies get confused navigationally,
and don't
land on the zebras. So that's the idea.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and there's a whole bunch more information on this theory and all the other theories, and that will also be up on geekspeak.org
eventually. A cohort of zebra.
Is it a cohort?
Well, that's one of them, and the other one is herd. But I love cohort.
Yeah,
a cohort of zebra, that works well.
Huh.
A school of whales, a pack of wolves, a flock of sheep, a colony of rabbits, a herd of pigs, a crowd of people.
Welcome to Animal Speak.
Mm.
Let's just read the rest of them.
Is it also a crowd of geeks?
I think it's a bite of geeks.
A bite of geeks. Mm-hmm. There you go.
Is it a bite of geeks?
We've debated this so many times on the show.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, there's episodes of this.
So I am a bit of geek.
Yeah,
we are
moving on. Let's talk
bite.
About car tech, shall we?
Oh, boy. Yeah.
What's going on with Honda?
Well, do we have a PSA?
Oh, yes. First PSA.
Okay. If you have a Nest Protect fire alarm, which I don't think that many people do because they're super expensive, but there's a Palo Alto company called Nest, and they make these networked home
equipment.
Bought
by Google recently, I believe.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically, there's an important security update that will be automatically downloaded to your fire alarm very soon, within the next month.
That makes it work.
Yeah.
Sorry. That now detects fires.
Right.
Yay.
Yay. So the PSA is that if you don't have it networked, you have to contact them in order to get the update.
Okay.
They're also offering a refund if you're really concerned about this.
What is the update, you know?
There's a feature where if your fire alarm's going off, like, you know how you're cooking and the smoke happens and the fire alarm goes off and it's annoying.
Yes.
You can wave it off. You can literally wave. They have a wave feature where you can wave at it and it'll temporarily, you know, silence that alarm.
That's great.
Yeah, but it's disabling the fire alarm.
Permanently.
For more time, I guess, than they initially intended it to.
Oh, no.
And it's never happened in real life.
Right.
It's just happened in the lab.
They just realized, waving actually turns it off for a day or something.
Right.
Some period of time.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And what is this fire alarm that's connected to network?
It's called a Nest Protect.
So what is the deal with that? Like, why does someone want to have...
Because if
a thermostat or a fire alarm.
Why would you want a computer on your face, Ben? I mean, come on.
If you're away from home and your home catches fire, it will tell you on your, it'll beep
it'll
your
tweet.
Phone.
And hopefully tell the fire department.
Right. <Yeah. laughs> That's what my assumption would be.
But, just the feature of going off because you burnt toast and you could wave at it, assuming that actually worked really well, is really nice. Because what happens most of the time is people go, oh, that's irritating. And then they go and they push the button or they pull
it
off the wall
battery.
Or they take the battery out and then they don't put it back.
Right. Mm.
So... that's not a good pattern.
So it's about having smarter devices that maybe are also aware a bit more of their surroundings.
Yeah, and if Google knows how much you have smoke in your house, it can sell things to you. No, I'm sorry.
Conspiracy.
It's all about data collection, too.
Of course it is, yeah.
All right. Honda Tech. Thanks,
Honda
Lindsay.
Tech. So this is – Honda is trialing this system in Japan – along with a couple other companies that are participating in this trial. It is known as Universal Traffic Management Systems. And the idea is that it takes advantage of car-to-car and car-to-infrastructure technology. So cars can communicate with each other, and cars can communicate with the infrastructure on the roads, like the traffic lights. So the thing that they're focusing on right now is trying to get these cars so they can get information from the cars around them and from the traffic lights on when the traffic light is likely to change. And then they can set their speed based on how likely the light is to change green or red soon or something like that. So
seems dangerous.
Well, we're not... I don't know. Actually, I disagree because right now what happens... I feel this urge in myself, right? Living in Sunnyvale, the lights sometimes seem like they're timed not so great. And so I find myself really wanting to speed all the time, just a little bit. Mm-hmm. So that way I can barely make the lights instead of continually barely missing the lights.
Yes.
So if we have these people who are speeding in order to catch the lights, and then we have people who are completely unaware of this and are just driving like normal, you have a discrepancy between the cars on the road and then you have a potential safety issue. If instead all or many or most of the cars on the road knew when the light was going to change, then they could either speed up to make the light or slow down so that way they don't have to slam on their brakes and get rear-ended or something like that. So I think it's a fantastic idea. And I think with networking systems and, the fire alarm, the networked fire alarm, I might not go out and buy that. I don't know if that's as important. But things like networking cars together, I think that's a really important thing to do, because if you asked someone who was born before cars existed, hey, I've got an idea. Let's put a bunch of humans into a metal box and then hurdle them down the road at 60 miles
an
hour.
That's crazy talk.
I don't know. I don't think that
seems very
safe.
On top of a gasoline engine.
On top of a thing that's constantly exploding under your hood.
If you're curious what network communication with cars kind of is like and you travel with somebody else, I suggest getting the application Waze, Waze. Mm-hmm. Don't use it while you're the driver, but as a passenger, it's really interesting to see what other people are collecting and knowing about where you are. It's a wonderful thing to use if you're commuting a lot, because you can take a look prior to leaving which path you're to take depending on traffic. And yeah. If this is built into cars, much better society and traffic flow.
Yeah.
And therefore people will use cars more.
I don't know. Well,
hey,
we're use cars more safely.
We're going to continue cars talk on Geek Speak here in a second. We got a break. And we're also going to take a call. Well, let's go with Dan right now. Dan from Seaside, tell us about meteorites, please. I surprised Dan.
Hello.
Hey, Dan, you're on air with Geeks.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. You have some information about meteors?
Yeah, I wanted to just say, I heard one of you mention that terminal velocity is going to be different if it's burning versus when it's not. And it really, it's going to have the same terminal velocity in either case. It's going to be, once it reaches that terminal velocity, whether it's burning or not, it's going to still have friction acting on it.
Mm-hmm.
And have, I think that terminal velocity of about 300 miles an hour is pretty close to what it could be.
Yeah, what I was saying about that, to be specific, is that if it is really, really hot, it could be traveling faster than its Like if it could be decelerating because of the atmospheric pressure on it. So that's the what I was trying to say. Of course, it's always at its terminal velocity if it's in free fall, in the sense that either it's accelerating or staying the same speed or decelerating. But those are all frictional forces acting upon it. So do you understand more what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I think I do. You're saying that. So you're saying if it's burning, though, that it could be experiencing an additional frictional force? Is that what you're saying?
No, I think it's that you've got a burning rock and you've got a not burning rock. In either case, the terminal velocity would be the same. But
right.
With a rock that's going faster than its terminal velocity, it'll be slowing down and probably also be hotter because of the additional frictional forces acting upon it. And so maybe if you have a rock that's decelerating, it's still going to have the same terminal velocity, but it will be traveling faster because it hasn't yet reached its terminal velocity when it's hot.
If it's
cooled off, then it's no longer experiencing the forces that make it hot. So
I always thought about terminal velocity being a match of the object's mass and the friction acting upon it and the gravitational pull. So those forces balancing. If it is decelerating because of air friction, and it's heating up severely, and it's starting to decelerate, hasn't it not really gotten to a terminal velocity, which I think of as an equilibrium state? Or am I misunderstanding terminal velocity?
Yeah, that's correct. So before it reaches terminal velocity, it's going to be accelerating. However, once it reaches terminal velocity, you see, there's only two forces. Let's just take the simple case. There's only two forces. You got the weight of the object, which is its mass times gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And you got the frictional force. Before it reaches terminal velocity, the weight is actually bigger than the frictional force. And
mm-hmm.
then as it moves faster and faster and faster, the frictional force is proportional to the velocity squared. So once it reaches that terminal velocity, those two forces are then equal.
Right.
So the frictional force is actually going to be greatest.
I see.
Once it's reached terminal velocity than before that.
Okay, so if an object is coming at us and it's accelerating, 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 then it starts interacting with our atmosphere. Our atmospheric density changes over time, therefore the friction changes over time. And theoretically, if it's heating up enough, it's changing mass as it goes, because like the heating
pieces might be coming off.
Pieces could be coming off, but I guess if it's just a black body and pieces aren't coming off, it's not changing mass. So what you're saying is that as it comes in high speed, it's accelerating the entire time. Then it hits our atmosphere. As soon as it starts to decelerate, would you call that terminal velocity? Or when it's no longer accelerating, would you call that terminal velocity? Or you see what I'm saying? There's a period here where the forces are starting to balance, but they haven't balanced yet.
Right. So I guess the way I would look at it, it's coming in from space, and then when it experiences the force of the Earth, it starts to accelerate towards the Earth at that point.
Yeah.
And then that continues and enters the Earth's atmosphere. It's still accelerating downward, as it enters the Earth's atmosphere, the frictional force starts to increase.
Mm-hmm.
And then once it's going to keep accelerating, but at a lower and lower rate. And then once it's reached terminal velocity, the acceleration is then zero, but
yeah.
Its velocity is quite fast.
Well, see, that's the thing is I don't understand. If I take a rock and I drop it from a plane,
uh-huh.
it will reach terminal velocity really quickly, but it will not heat up.
But that's because it's not coming in
at high speeds. So I think of the terminal velocity as about 200 miles per hour. That's not going to be something where it's hot. So it got hot because it was going faster than its terminal velocity, and it got all the energy of its speed had to decrease to the point of terminal velocity. At that point, that's where all the energy came from. It's that transitional point. So I don't think of that thing as the terminal velocity. I think it's actually decelerating to its terminal velocity.
Right, so
but maybe
from outer space, I guess the point, I guess, is when it came in from outer space, it was moving quite a bit faster
mm-hmm.
than when you dropped it from the plane. So at that point, yeah, it's a different situation from, I see the point you're raising. When you drop it from a plane, its initial velocity in the vertical direction is zero.
Right.
When it comes in from space, it's going to have a much greater initial velocity.
And that's why I think of hot asteroids as always going faster than their terminal velocity. That's
okay.
How I think of it in my mind. But I could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take this for another time. We've got more news. Thank you so much for calling. I love professors
sure.
calling in.
Yeah, thanks.
Dan is a professor of physics at CSUMB in Seaside. And thank you for calling in, Dan.
Thank you. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, this is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are Ben and Lindsay. We're taking calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. We were talking about Honda Tech, so we're in the car area. A little interlude on meteorite speeds. Tell us about something else car-related. Would you, Lindsay?
Have you seen the Tesla Model S driving around? Drool. I love
it. I know. I have a friend that has one. Oh. Talk about drool. I know.
Yeah. It's an electric car, right?
Yes, yeah. It is an electric car, and it's got a new undercarriage, as I recall. They've made it a hard undercarriage because objects were piercing the battery shell or something very bad like that. Twice.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, Tesla's pretty awesome in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I want to tour their facility at some point. I think that would be fun. So one Tesla Model S owner, you know, we've got a lot of geeks and savvy people. There's a 4-pin port on the left side of the dashboard. And this guy there's a few people that have done this since, but I think this person took an Ethernet cable and made it so that they could plug it into this 4-pin on one end and have an Ethernet on the other end, and then plugged it into their computer.
Oh, what could they do?
Yeah. And it turns out that the Tesla has an internal network going.
Yeah.
It's 100 megabits per second full duplex Ethernet network consisting of three devices with assigned IP addresses in the 192.168.90.0.
Really? It's like total standard.
Yeah.
Oh, that's well.
Exactly.
And I know one of these devices, of course, is the screen. Right.
The center console, which is, I didn't know it before I read this, at 17 inches.
Oh, yeah. You got to sit in one. Lindsay, go down to one of the Tesla shops and sit in one. It's a pretty impressive vehicle.
I'm going to want one then, and I can't.
You can't buy one. Give the decision making power of buying one to somebody else, then go look at it and come back and go, can I please buy one? They'll say no.
All right, I won't take my purse. So the other things is a dashboard / nav screen, and then the third device is an unknown device. We don't know what that is. There's ports and services open on these devices, which is common network stuff. SSH on 22, Telnet on 23, 53.
That's awesome. HTTP. I could run the GeekSpeak web server from that car.
No, you'll void your warranty.
That's true.
And you'll get a Nastygram from Tesla.
Oh, really?
It's proprietary. So don't do it.
Oh, Ethernet's proprietary? I didn't know.
You know, accessing their network is.
Interesting. In the car you own. Or can you only lease them? I'm not even sure. So what could they do when they hacked into the Tesla and their own Tesla vehicles? Could they do anything besides poking around, which is pretty interesting?
Yeah.
Were they able to do anything else?
They didn't say. They just loaded up port 80 and it showed everything, all the songs that were playing on a web page.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So now we know that the screen is driven by, you know, a web server. But it turns out that the operating system is a modified version of Ubuntu using an EX3 file system. That's one thing we did learn.
That's strange. They'd use Ubuntu. I'd assume they'd make their own distro, but are you sure it's not just a Debian version?
Why reinvent the wheel?
Yeah, well,
of course it's. I didn't even mean that pun. But like, you know, of course they're going to be running Ethernet inside. That makes total sense to me. Of course they're going to have all the standards and everything because they just need a bunch of devices networking.
I'm surprised Ubuntu. The only thing I'm surprised about that is that they use Ubuntu as the operating system. But then again, you know, I use it, so maybe that just makes sense generally. Even when you got a car that's electric and quiet and beautiful and sleek, and yeah, I want one too. I'm not going to buy one.
That pretty soon they're going to close this off so that people can't access it. But who knows?
All right. Huh. Ben, car story?
Speaking of quiet, the Tesla Model S was featured on a 60 Minutes on Sunday night.
I've heard of that show.
Last Sunday. I've heard of that show. It's new, right? No. It's been around for a long time. And you may have also noticed something odd about this particular show if you watched it. It used some footage of the Tesla Model S cruising around and like scenic byways and long highways is what it said. I didn't actually see the segment. And the audio, it sounded like the car was making engine noises.
That's not right.
And there was one time where there was a clear, audible downshift.
No, that just didn't happen either. On a Tesla?
On a Tesla.
That's great. So
a Tesla is an electric,
some
silent
sound
car.
Engineer like added this stuff in?
Yeah, they're like, oh, that's a cool car. I should probably add a relatively cool sound effect to to go along with it.
I wonder if that person was watching the video thinking, oh, they must have made a mistake and not put the audio in here.
I love the idea of an editor being like, okay, the commercial's done. No, that car, it needs to have sound. And the editor being like, okay, whatever.
So, of course, CBS had to make a statement, and they basically just said, quote, "Our video editor made an audio editing error in our report about Elon Musk and Tesla. We regret the error, and it is being corrected online."
So, you know, just like every space movie you've ever seen where things blow up in space and make sound. It's the same type of thing. We just expect a certain thing.
Yeah, but Tesla hasn't made a spaceship yet, has he?
Elon Musk has.
Elon Musk, sorry.
Hey, you know what? When I said, hey, call in, people did.
Whoa, did they?
Yeah. Sweet. Even Fred from Watsonville called in, and Fred wants to know about what? Hi, Fred. Oh, I got to push the button, too. Hey, Fred. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you. I wanted to go back to the very beginning of the show when we're talking about backing up new Mac.
Ben's use of Super Duper. About, yeah.
Right, using Super Duper. And I used to use Super Duper years ago and then just started relying on Time Machine, the built-in backup software from Apple. Is there some reason not to trust Time Machine?
Well,
I have opinions too. Go, Ben.
I use Time Machine as well as Super Duper. Confused yet? Well, okay, so basically my backup solution for this new computer is going to be that I'll back up my computer to my big external hard drive, my 4 terabyte hard drive, using Time Machine, right?
Okay.
So that's all going to be done using
just
Apple's
the default
stock
Apple
Time
choice, right?
Nothing special. I'll probably partition the 4 gig or the 4 terabyte
to match your.
And then I've also got a 2 terabyte hard drive, which I'll be able to carry with me because it runs on USB power. That one I'm going to use Super Duper to back it up also to the 4 terabyte because I don't think you can do that with Time Machine. I think Time Machine is built in the typical Apple way with very limited options, but specifically the things that most people need, which is to back up their internal laptop computer to an external drive. I have another external drive, which I need to back up to another external drive. So if I want to do that, I can do it manually, or I can use something like Super Duper or Carbon Copy.
So are you making 2 copies of your laptop? One with Super Duper, one with Time Machine?
Right now, I won't be.
Okay.
But I actually have another hard drive kicking around.
It's that you only will
like
eventually.
It's like a 500 gigabyte hard drive. I think it's a 750, so I'll use that.
You know, and Fred, one of the things that's wonderful about Time Machine is that it does keep a chronological change list, kind of like source control, right?
Uh-huh.
So as you change a file, it writes the new one. And if it has space, it holds the old one as well. So you can go back in time. That's why it's called Time Machine. It's awesome. I have had a lot of trouble with Time Machine over the years, getting it to be reliable, rebuilding systems. Now, I'm doing things like using a network-attached storage device and a mount, and that is one of the reasons why I've had trouble. I use Time Machine for people's machines that I help with. If they've got a Mac, I get an external USB drive, I stick it in the back, I set up the Time Machine to just do it. And that way I know when grandma calls and says, this is problematic, I can go over there in a few minutes, have her machine back and forth, except that it's not a few minutes. Time Machine's recovery time is a lot. Super Duper, if you do a complete clone, its recovery is just point to the new drive. It's a complete copy. It's pretty awesome.
But there's no version control. You can't
say,
oh, I want this file.
It does have that support, but doing that's kind of a pain because then you've got these dot folders. Yeah, you can turn that on.
Yeah. It's not easy.
So I think if Time Machine's working for you, great. I also want to urge people when they think about a backup solution that it's a backup. It's a secondary copy. Never think of it as a primary copy. Always have 2 copies, at least maybe 3, especially for your important files. All of my photos I've got 3 copies of. So does that answer your question, Fred?
It does. Thank you very much. I had another question, which sort of goes quite far afield and is a much longer topic, but I was very intrigued by your whole discussion of version control and the advantages of Git. And 2 things occurred to me. One is the sort of holy grail of an alternative to the standardized testing regime in schools is to develop an easy-to-use but sophisticated personal curation where students, instead of having tests and grades, would just begin learning to curate their own personal learning portfolio, and that would be the evidence of their learning.
Yeah.
So to take a software like Git that saves incremental versions and adapt it to the school situation where you can have not only archiving of individual pieces, but you now, I've archived my first grade experience.
Yeah. I have to say that you've just, Fred, you've just cursed me with a major project I have to do now for my children. So thank you so very much.
Yeah, the lifelong learning CV.
That's
searchable. You can figure out what you learned.
Well, see, our computer should be doing this for us anyway, right? Like, that it's so hard to do this stuff is kind of, it's just a sign of our time. Eventually, it will not be. Yeah. Eventually, you'll ever create a file. You will have it indefinitely, easily available, all of that stuff. And these are the tools that software programmers use because, of course, they're very proficient in the tool that they're using. So that's why they show up first in software development. I think you're right. I think we'll see this more built into our everyday computing experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when you think about backups, just going back to the first thing that you said, backups used to be something that you had to know how to do. With something like Apple's Time Machine or any of the other things that might come in built in or be, you know, set up and set them and go and they just go on their own, you don't have to think about it anymore. Same thing with the kind of thing that we're talking about, you know, like eventually it just might be automatic. But for now, you need to know how to use it.
Fred, thank you for the call.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
We're got a question from Marina, Georgia. There's two names, there's places. From Marina, California, Georgia, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What's your question?
So I have a question. Say I have an idea for a website, and I build it, or I have somebody else build it for me. How is it copyrighted, or can anybody copy it if they want to?
Anything you write is copyrighted. If you employ someone else and they write something for you, assuming you've signed something that says that they're done via paid work, anything they write is copyrighted. Therefore, all source control is copyrightable. When you release a website, you make a copyright statement about it. It's your content. In general, in the U.S., you don't have to make a declaration. It's just automatically copyrighted by the person that's done the work. So that's the copyright solution. If you're talking about patents, it's a different subject. And unfortunately, we don't have enough time to talk about that on today's show. But thank you for the call, George. I want to get to one more question. So thank you so much.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. James from Santa Cruz. Hi.
Hey, you guys. Great show today. Thank you.
Thank you. What's your question or comment?
Oh, yeah. So I just have a comment. Hi, Lindsay. I think I worked with you at Lutris and SEO at different times.
Oh, yeah. Hey.
Hi. And so I want to give just a quick little plug for software quality engineers with all these great...
You know what? Ideas. You know what, James? We're totally out of time.
Okay.
Stay on the line, okay?
Okay. Will do.
All right. This is GeekSpeak. Registered service mark of online site with David Lawrence. I'm Lyle Troxell. On the air with me is Lindsay Lonnie and Ben Jaffe. And we'll be back next week. Please stay with us. Answering the phones was Rick, and this is KUSP Santa Cruz. Thanks for listening. See you next week. And on